Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
It's the Perpetual Notion Machine, excuse me, edition April 10th, 2025. Thanks for joining us in this half hour of evening science news. My name is Dee Crouch, and I'm joined here in the studio by Dave Lovelace, a research scientist at the UW Geology Museum with specializations in vertebrate paleontology and the geosciences. Welcome, Dave. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
As a scientist in these fields, paleontology, the geosciences, what is your day-to-day life like? What do these kinds of scientists do?
For the most part, my day-to-day life probably is pretty boring in some sense. I sit in front of a computer and I'm writing or looking at data, making graphs. So a lot of it is kind of the analysis of data or information that we've collected. But the fun part is that data collection itself, right? So we get to spend a lot of time usually in the summers going out to the field. We collect, in my case, I go out and collect fossils, or I might collect rock samples or measure some of the rock units to try to tell a story, to try to build a story. And so once we get all that stuff back, that's when the real work of interpreting the data, kind of looking at what things look like, trying to figure out what's going on, actually cleaning the fossils. So I would say, a majority of my time really is looking at or trying to think about and build the story. But the most fun is when you're, cleaning the fossils and actually exposing these bones that have never been seen by anyone. And that's pretty thrilling. And, of course, the thrill of discovery is great. You get to find things out in the field. And I have a lot of students in the lab. And so it keeps it pretty dynamic and pretty active in there.
What inspired you to get involved with these fields? And are they, is there a lot, first of all, is there a lot of crossover between, working with a lot of geoscience stuff versus materials that you have in paleontology?
There is. And this, it's kind of funny. This is what got me into, I think, the sciences as a whole. I had a very circuitous route. After high school, I ended up getting a certification in diesel mechanicking. So I was a diesel mechanic for a while and was working in the oil field. And, some of the folks there were like, hey, you should look at academia. And I'm like, what's that? So kind of got me interested in answering questions, like looking deeper into geology, because growing up, I grew up in Wyoming, and all the mountains and a lot of the structures that we see and talk about in geology, whether it's an anticline or mountain building, it's all right there. And so I grew up with it, and once I started kind of learning and piecing those pieces of the puzzle together, and you could actually see, like looking at a mountain, it's like, oh, there's the thrust fault. I can see where this thing like ran up on top of the other section and how things are built over time. And so it's like this almost 4D model, because you can see it, but then you can actually play it backwards in time and kind of figure out what's going on. And so I loved those kind of puzzle pieces. And so that got me into geology. And growing up, I had always loved playing with bones and stones. So we'd walk across the prairie and I'd pick up random bones here and there and like try to assemble rabbit skeletons or antelope or whatever we could find. So when I found out from one of my professors, they're like, you realize there's like dead things in the rocks, right? And I'm like, okay, cool. So it was a great, perfect combination of geology and paleontology and the fossils themselves. So oftentimes in vertebrate paleontology, you're either a biologist or you're a geologist. And I couldn't make up my mind, so I kind of ended up doing it all. I would be more of a paleoecologist. I study the ecology as a whole, so all the organisms, but also looking at the environment as you interpret it through the rock record. And so that's where I love this part of the sciences, because it really is weaving a narrative. It's building a story based on all the pieces that you can find.
Going off of that, you've participated in many interesting research projects involving things like a mass dinosaur death assemblage, investigating cave stratigraphy, fossilized turtle tracks, and even fossilized chinskin from duck-billed dinosaurs. Do you have a particular favorite find or research that you've done?
Wow, it's a great question. I always think it's like asking an artist what their favorite color is. I mean, I guess you do have a favorite at some level, but they all blend together and they all work beautifully together. The cave one is kind of fun. It was a complete tangent from what I normally do. And so I was invited out to Natural Trap Cave, which is this 90-foot fall into a pit cave. So it's the opening's about the size of an average bathroom. So it's a pretty small opening. And then you fall 90 feet into this huge cavern, which is great for fossils because, you know, animals walk along and they go, bah! You know, they don't see the edge coming. And this was really opened in the Pleistocene. So we get a lot of the same kind of fossils that we would get in Wisconsin. So a lot of mammoths, mastodons, dire wolves, those are all in the news now. Those were the types of animals we were working on, but I actually went in as a stratigrapher. I went in as a geologist to try to interpret what was going on with all the different layers. Because in a cave, it gets wickedly complex. Like, yeah, it's very, very unusual. And it was a lot of fun for me because it really was the most challenging, like sedimentology, like looking at the rock layers. It's the most challenging thing I've ever done in the science. And I loved it. It was great. Favorite, you know, so that was always a bucket list growing up in Wyoming. And so getting to go in there and being invited was a huge thing. But it's hard to say. Like, I think the accidental finds are probably the ones that are my favorite. And so working on Supersaurus, so I worked on the biggest land animal ever to live, right? Or the longest, at least. And we were excavating that. And as you're removing all this rock that's on top of it, you know, picks and shovels and just trying to get down to the bone layer itself for this huge animal, we ended up finding on accident, unfortunately with the pick, we knocked the tip off of a nose of a tiny little dinosaur, smaller than a chicken. And so it was like finding things like that accidentally. It's pretty crazy. And I actually got to publish that with Scott Hartman, who's a researcher. And he, an instructor in zoology now. And so we had grown up together, like college-wise, like I knew him since 93. And so for us to like be able to write that while we were in Madison was kind of fun too, and like a big deal for us. So that's probably one of my favorites.
Whoa. I have to ask, you said there was in the cave, there was a 90-foot pit.
Yeah.
So did you have to like climb down there?
Yeah, so we would rappel down, and then you'd have to ascend back up, and it's a free fall in effect. So you're free rappelling down to the base, and then use your equipment and kind of climb back out on the ropes. Lots of fun. An adventure every day.
That's what we like to imagine when we talk about fields like this, you know, going out and having a bit of adventure, but with you, it actually happens.
It's been known to happen, that's for sure.
One of the discoveries that you've been involved in recently is, and correct me if I'm wrong in saying this, the oldest known dinosaur remains in the Northern Hemisphere. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that's a lot of what we've been working on really since I started at UW. So I was here for my graduate, my PhD, and I started in 2008, and during my field work, this again, it was an accidental discovery. I had some undergraduates who were out helping me for the summer. They were museum volunteers, And we went out for a couple weeks. And where we were camping, it was this campground that I grew up, you know, literally camping at. I mean, it was 30 miles from my house where I grew up. And we're sitting there, and this is a place that's notorious for not having fossils. And so we're just sitting on this rock, enjoying our meal. And one of the students is like running around picking up rabbit bones. And he brings back one. And, you know, he's got an assortment of rabbit, you know, modern bone. And there was one in there. I'm like, wow, that's a really weird looking one. But it was white. It had little red dirt kind of stuck to it. It looked just like a modern bone. And then I picked it up. I'm like, that's a fossil. There's something. Wait, where'd you get this? And so we started looking around, and that was the first thing that like clued us in to, no, there's actually some really cool stuff here. So we ended up finding a little jaw to an animal called a rankosaur. It's a little reptile. But that's what really started the ball rolling. And in 2013 was my very first year as a UW employee. Like, I had gotten my PhD. I was starting as a scientist for the UW Geology Museum. And part of my job is to take students out to the field. And so our very first expedition out, we were going to go camping, you know, our first spot, and there was a big forest fire in the area. So we had to actually pivot and kind of make up what we were going to do on the fly. And looking at Google Earth, I found this tiny little outcrop of the rock that I was really interested in, kind of surrounded by all these really, really young rocks. I'm like, hey, let's go check that out. We got to like ford a river. This should be fun. So we ended up going out there, and long story short, we found a couple bones, you know, a number of stuff, but the two of them were like, this is like a leg bone. This is an upper leg bone, a femur of a dinosaur, I think. It has all the structures of it. This is so cool. And then we found a couple other bones that were, you know, backbones, and we found an ankle. And the ankle bone is another one that's diagnostic. So if you have anything other than the skull, you want an ankle and you want a leg bone. And so to have these of this dinosaur, we're like, that's really, I mean, like, mind-blowingly cool. But it's the oldest dinosaur in Wyoming, because there are no Triassic dinosaurs. So I'm working on rocks that are around 230 to 210. But the thing is, nobody knew what the actual age of these rocks were. So collect the specimen. It goes back, and we're, like, working on it slowly here and there. But ultimately, I can't really say a lot about it other than it's a dinosaur. We know roughly where it fits in the story of dinosaurs, but we don't know when it happened. So we had to do a whole lot more research, especially since this is a formation that nobody had really worked for decades. I mean, the last time somebody really did any good geology out there was 1942. So
wow.
It'd been a while. So there was a lot of work to do to catch us up. But that specimen does end up becoming, you know, this year, so it was January that was officially published as the oldest dinosaur in the Northern Hemisphere, but it was found in 2013.
Wow. Oh my God. What's it like finding something that old that hasn't seen the light of day for God knows how long, or at least been, you know, picked up by a human being, you know, the first time it's actually been found? What does that feel like?
You know, I mean, to me, I think it's pretty extraordinary, right? It's special. Everything that we find or uncover, it has some story to it. And I think knowing that you're the first person to see that, it's pretty powerful. It's pretty special. I mean, clearly I like enough that I keep going back and doing it. And it definitely pulls me back out to the field. Like, I really want that sense of discovery. But a lot of that has shifted, like, over the last 10 years, taking students out. I think the most joyful thing for me is watching them have that first moment of, whoa, I am holding this like little skull or this bone of this cool animal that nobody's ever seen. It might be the first one ever found. And yeah, it's pretty amazing to watch that happen.
Can you tell me more about this little guy? I'm going to try to pronounce the name. I can't promise accuracy. I read that it's a Shoshone word, Avetum Bondoivici.
Really close. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
yeah, so the name Avetum Bondoivici is a Shoshone word that means long ago dinosaur. And so Avetum is the word for long ago. And a lot of the stories, the elders would tell me, the stories would begin with Avetum. And so they'd sit around and be talking to Avetum. which is, you know, like we would say, a long time ago. It's the same thing. So they draw it out. And so that's how, you know, Avetum, it's this long ago dinosaur. And, you know, the Shoshone people didn't really have a name for dinosaur. So it's a relatively new construct. But one of the elder that I was working with, Reba, so Reba Turan is the language keeper for the tribe. And she had been taught by one of the other elders the word for dinosaur in that Banduivichi. And so Ban is the word for water, and water holds a very special place, and it has a possession. And Duivichi is the name for the salamander, which also means handsome young man, which is fantastic. Because if you look at a salamander, it's super, super cute, really colorful. And so that was the word put together is what they chose to represent dinosaur. So it can either be a salamander or a dinosaur, depending on the context. And so long ago, dinosaur was how it got its name. But yeah. Oh,
wow. This half hour is flying by. We're already 16 minutes in. I'm speaking with Dave Lovelace, a vertebrate paleontologist and researcher for the UW Geology Museum. So, Dave, when it comes to finding fossilized material, how do you go about determining the age of something like that? How do you date something like that?
Yeah, so like Avetum, right? We found this fossil in 2013, and we knew it was a dinosaur, but we didn't know how old it was. And so, you know, when you look at the bone, the top of the femur is about the size of the last digit on your thumb. So it's a very small animal. We say it's like a chicken-sized dinosaur, with long tail, longish neck. And probably would have been feathered like a chicken too. Maybe not quite so advanced, but, you know, it's totally a feathered, cute little guy. But yeah, when is this thing run around? We know that the roughly what the ecosystem looks like, but we had no sense of exactly when it happened in space and time. And so what we end up doing is, in this case, we collect rock samples, and there are many different techniques for looking at the age of rocks. So like in the cave, I would use carbon dating was one of the most common methods. You can use another one, argon-argon. And so you're looking at some sort of unstable element at some level that decays into a stable product. And then you measure the ratio of those. And so it depends, you know, so you can use carbon, you can use argon, you can use uranium and lead, which is what we end up using. And it all depends on how far back in time you're going, because carbon dating only works for 50,000-ish years. So when I'm doing rocks that are like 200 plus million years, you need a different tool. And so we collect these rocks, we crush them up, and we sort out the heavy minerals, and zircons are the tool that's the mineral that we're really going for. So these individual zircon crystals, when they crystallize, it's in a magmatic chamber, and we're looking at crystals that have been ejected out in ash in a volcanic eruption. They float through the air, and then they fall down to the ground, and they get incorporated into the strata. Ideally, we find an ash layer, but in this case, they're just mixed up. You know, the river, the rainwaters take all that ash and put it in the river, but those crystals are still there, and they're really, really resistant. So we basically take those, put them on a mass spec of different sorts, shoot them with lasers, and we measure the amount of lead and the amount of uranium, look at that, and that gives us an age. And then we can kind of refine that with other techniques, but from that, we knew that we had rocks that were stacked. We had three sequential dates, one at 229, and then one at 227.9, and then 227.5. So we knew we had rocks that were at least 229 million years. And then our fossil, the little dinosaur, came from quite a bit below that 229. So it had to be older.
Right.
So then we just used some model, just basic numeric modeling techniques, and we could predict it's probably about 230 million years, which, ta-da, is the oldest age known for any dinosaur globally. So about 230 is the oldest. And so we don't claim we have the oldest in the world, but we have the first and oldest in the Northern Hemisphere, which was a big deal because the next dinosaur known, the oldest, the previous oldest, was 10 million years younger. And so we really filled this big gap in the dinosaur story, which is pretty special for this little critter.
That's amazing. What does that mean for the broader field of paleontology then? Or is that to be determined still?
You know, the biggest thing is it answered some questions, it challenged others, and now we have even more, which is good, I guess, if you're in the business of trying to answer questions. The story that we have is this dinosaur filled this 10 million year gap. So now we have a dinosaur in the Northern Hemisphere, the same age as the oldest ones in the Southern Hemisphere. At this time, the continent was all the continents were jammed together in the supercontinent of Pangaea. So it'd have been like, if you take your globe, all the continents would form the letter C, a giant C right across the middle of the Earth with the equator running right through the middle of it. And with the dinosaurs that we knew from the Southern Hemisphere, you know, the thought was that the climate at the time, because it was super hot, and it actually, because of Pangaea, changed the whole entire circulatory system of the oceans and the atmosphere, that there were these big dry belts across the equator. And so they thought that they were impenetrable by dinosaurs. They couldn't get past that until a major environmental event happened that allowed them to cross. And so our animal actually shows that that dinosaurs were already here at that same time. And so they had a global distribution. So it challenged that idea of having this big climatic barrier and having effectively what they called a diachronous rise. So you had a rise of dinosaurs in the south, and then eventually they sneak into the north and have the rise of the dinosaurs in the north. But what we're showing is that actually we just don't have a good handle on the age of some of these rocks and some of the deep story. So it's kind of a fun. Most of my colleagues are like, yeah, no, cool, nice. Yep, I believe it. I thought there was going to be a little bit more, you know, fun, challenging here. I'm sure that'll come. You know, like all science, new data comes in and you have to change your thoughts.
On that subject, what are some of the difficulties that come with your field? For instance, you can only really theorize off of the data that you have, right? And so that all really depends on how quickly it's found, right?
Yeah. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day and we were trying to write down ideas on what is science? What is the scientific method? And we talk about it, you know, you have an idea, you look at data, you make observations, you piece it together, come up with an idea, and then figure out an experiment. I'm like, I don't have experiments. It doesn't quite work that same way, at least not in the classic sense, right? So the difficulty, I think, is whenever you have an idea that you really want to test, you can't just go out and test it. You have to have that data. It has to be found. Now you can go out purposefully and try to find this missing piece or whatever it is that you're looking for, but the odds of finding things just because you want to is really, really small. And so accidental finds are a huge part of this. But there have been a few success stories where people make a prediction, go out, and they end up finding the fossil. The famous fossil Tiktaalik is a great example of that. You know, this kind of amphibifish, you know, that's kind of the rise of vertebrates starting to move towards gaining access to land. And it filled a major gap. But it was somebody that was like, okay, it should be in this environment. It should be at this time period. Where are rocks that exist that are in the, that have all these things? And then they went out and, you know, it was a struggle. They worked for years and years and didn't find it, but then they did. So I think that's the biggest challenge. And then, you know, the other pieces, the dating is an issue for sure, right? Like there's a lot of rock and we have a lot of things, but knowing where they fit in space and time is kind of the big puzzle piece.
Can it be difficult keeping up with new information as it's released, or even just like getting information to the public in kind of a timely manner?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, right? And I work on a lot of things other than just dinosaurs. So staying kind of on top of the, you know, new advances in either sedimentology or how we're interpreting things, yeah, it's a lot. But at this point, I also have a number of students and colleagues that are like, hey,
can you hear me? Okay.
Sorry. Oh. I don't know if that came through.
So, yeah, we go out and try to figure out. I'm sorry, I lied. That was the voice of God. Yeah, so, you know, it's, what was I saying? Where were we?
Oh, I had asked you if it was hard to kind of get information out to the public. Yeah.
So, So, fortunately, I have a lot of students and colleagues, and that's where we're at. Somebody's like, hey, you're working on this. Have you seen this? You know, this new thing? And they go, oh, no. And so we share, a lot of my colleagues, you know, and students share information back and forth. So it's in that way we can keep up with kind of the most germane things. And as you're doing research, you learn all sorts of crazy new stuff. But disseminating, right? Getting information out to the public. It's a challenge in one respect because, you know, we go through the peer review process, you get your paper published, but then how do you actually talk about it? Mm. Now, little dinosaurs, turns out, is easier to talk about and people want to know a little bit more about than, say, mass death assemblage of big amphibians. But fortunately, we just published that paper and my student is getting people asking him about it. So it's through media, right? It's through folks that are looking at this, like yourself. I'm saying, hey, can you come tell us about what's going on? Because that's really our big opportunity to share a lot of this stuff with folks out there.
Yeah.
We need to be better science communicators, I think. All of us sciences.
Definitely. It can be difficult, for sure. One of the topics that you've discussed previously is the decolonization of vertebrate paleontology. How have social changes impacted your field, if you'd like to talk about it?
Sure. You know, one of the reasons that it took 10 years or now 12 years from when we first found that dinosaur to when we published it. And part of that was I had actually gone through the process with students of writing the paper up. And so about 2019, we were just about ready to publish it. We had actually had a name picked out for it. And I had used a kind of a very classic traditional way of naming things. It was in Latin. And then I put a species name on it that was honoring a former advisor, professor, and like, that's pretty common. And that I was just doing what I was taught to do and what I witnessed my peers doing. And then, social changes came, right? And so the pandemic hit, the murder of George Floyd, this is kind of the social awareness. And I think a lot of us were working from home remotely, and my students were a big driver, as well as my partner. She's very into and knowledgeable about social justice, and I was learning a lot. And at this time, I was like, "Well, we had written this land acknowledgement, but it just fell flat. Like it just didn't feel like it did anything." Yes, it was nice. I'm glad we acknowledged, but what else can we do? And so it was through that we actually dove into kind of the social justice side of this, and decolonizing paleontology relates to the naming practice. And so it is a colonial form of how we name things in this Latin system. And it has a deep history that has a whole another segment we could talk about. But the bottom line is we really wanted to grapple with that and figure out what we could do. So we ended up thinking, well, let's get better representation. So we reached out to the tribes on the Wind River Reservation and we built a partnership with them. And that's what ultimately kind of started that. That's why the names of the animals are all in Shoshone or Arapaho.
That's really cool. It also speaks to my love of anthropology. So the sciences, they meet. This half hour has just flown by. I have so many more questions. And just this last minute that we have, do you want to shout anything out, any future projects?
You know, we're just continuing on trying to explore and understand this particular time period. And I'll give a shout out to my family. You know, my partner and my kids have been out. My son, since he was, one, out in the field, and my daughter's been out every year of her life. They've been out to the field with me. So, yeah, give a shout out to them for all the support and all my family. So, thanks, y'all.
It's been great talking to you, Dave. Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine on WORT. Thanks to our engineer, Emmett Riley. Next up is Radio Literature with your host, Melvin Hinton.
I'm Mark Thomas, a retired union activist. Tune into the Access Hour Monday at 7 p.m. when I'll interview Mary Englem and Annie Havel about their experience as politically active working class women. Workers' history by people who lived it on the Access Hour Monday at 7 p.m. on WRT Madison. When we stand hand in hand, that's the power, that's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, would you
Melvin, are you there?
I'm there. I'm here.
Okay, we're live now.
Oh, I didn't hear the intro. Okay. Maybe you should signal me when it's time for me to come in, since I had some things I don't hear. Okay, Mending Wall by Robert Frost. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper bout boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing.